Welcome to another edition of The List, a Right Fiction podcast. We've got a great show for you all today about our favorite one-hit wonders. Before we get started, if you love the pod, please take a minute to rate, review, and subscribe on your listening app. It helps us reach new listeners like you. Also, be sure to check out our companion Spotify playlist with all our picks that we mentioned in the pod. The link is in the show details. Now, on to the show. A hit song is a hit song, and no one can take that away from you. However, a hit song doesn't necessarily lead to another hit song, or a career for that matter. When this happens to an artist, they get placed in the dreaded category of one-hit wonder. Over the years, we've seen many one-hit wonder lists or artist profiles on VH1 or TV1, and for me, they all feel, well, sad. Like, if someone is 22 and has a hit song, but doesn't have another one, was that the pinnacle for them? Is it all downhill at 22? Well, in some instances, yes. That's the end. But in other instances, these one-hit wonders have gone on to have long careers in music and also in other industries. Either way, though, whether an artist has a second hit or not, for one moment, they were at the top and no one can take that away from them. This is what we'll discuss today, our favorite one-hit wonders and why we love them. So hang out with us for a bit and see if our list matches yours. And with that, on to the show. Got my man Adam, got my man Freddie, got my man Brendan, and me, the John Stockton of podcast, Aaron Brown. And you know what, guys? I'm going to kick off this pod with my pick, my number three, one-hit wonder. And that song is All the Young Dudes, Mata Hoople, 1972. Great song written by David Bowie. For them, when he heard they were going to break up. Such an amazing tune. Every other song from Mata Hoople sucks. This song is a gem. And with that, I'm going to kick it to my buddy Adam for his number three pick.
I always feel like Bowie is singing that song anyway. It's like you kind of forget that it is Mata Hoople. I just kind of consider it a Bowie song.
Except for when you hear him sing the live version, it actually sounds better with Mata Hoople.
Huh. Well, there you go. And then the rest apparently in your mind. Anywho, my number three is an old R&B soul tune, Ooh Child by the Five Stair Steps. You know what? It's been done 6 million times, and especially in this pandemic time, it's the wrap a warm blanket around you song, and really is, you know, it's one of those wonders that withstood the test of time. Granted, they didn't write it themselves, but they were the first, and then everybody knows. You know this. People know this, even if they don't know it. It's insane, especially with this pandemic going on. People are having their warm blanket songs that things are going to be okay thing. It's, you know, but I couldn't tell you another solitary thing they've done. Not a blessed thing.
Yeah. You know what? And one of the reasons why it's a warm blanket song is because there's only like 5 words in the song. So that also helps.
You know, yeah, that it's easy helps. To remember, you know, yeah.
And from a nerdy perspective, that song is so interesting because it just has two sections. The song is in two different keys, and the keys are totally unrelated, and it just modulates back and forth between the A and the B section. That's the whole tune. It's so simple, but like interesting, like there's no connection between the two sections.
That is milking that hook until like, yeah, you took that hook and you got all you could get out of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my number three.
Yep. And Brendan. What's your number three, man?
Yeah. My number three is the song Plowed by 90s band Sponge. The song came out in 94. And I love this song, but I will say I think 100% of my love for this song is because of its use in Empire Records. It's like the best scene in the movie is when they're like revolting and they decide to throw the party and it's the damn the man save the empire. And then that guitar riff comes in and like, it's just, it's so perfect. So that's my number three.
Yeah. I got some words for you on that one. Freddie.
Yo.
What's your pick, man?
Louie Louie by the Kingsmen. Although it's not really by the Kingsmen. It was written by, I believe, a guy named Richard Berry. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep, Richard Berry.
And it was also recorded by a guy named Rockin' Robin Roberts. Not the pitcher.
Yeah, as I was saying, the pitcher?
Yep. Nope. And it was also recorded by a group called the Wailers, but not Bob Marley's Wailers. However, Bob Marley loved that melody and that rhythm. And back in the beginning, early days of the Wailers, the Jamaican Wailers, used that in a couple of different songs, that rhythm. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun.
I'll be darned. Yeah, right.
Yeah. But yeah, this song means a lot to me personally because I remember actually owning the 45 on Wand Records when it came out in 1963. I was negative 3 years old. No, I'm kidding. I was really young. That's my number three pick.
Well, real quick question on that with Freddie. Do you know what they're saying?
I know what they're not saying.
I think the FBI knows too.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's a controversy there.
All right. I'm going to give you my number two pick. I love this song dearly. It's from 1973. It's Midnight at the Oasis, Maria Muldaur. Such a great tune. She was a kind of a folky from, you know, Greenwich Village, kind of came up in that same scene with all those folkies back then. And she ended up actually singing backup for the Grateful Dead in the late 70s. But this tune was a huge hit for her. And it's, you know, it's just an awesome song, and everything she's done probably after and before it has sucked terribly. But including her voice. Her voice on the song sucks, but it's just the perfect song. And that's why it's my number two pick.
No punches.
With that.
Pulling no punches today, huh?
Yeah, don't hold anything back.
Well, it's one hit wonders, you know? I mean, there's a reason. There's, and we'll talk about maybe some of these reasons. But,
yeah, wow.
I'm giving some breadcrumbs to why I think some of these were one hit wonders.
I hit breadcrumbs, more like loaves of bread.
And then, Adam, what's your number two pick?
My number two is another 90s act, Blind Melon's No Rain. Everyone remembers the B-Girl video that kind of banked the thing. And I mean, really, this became one hit wonder because Shannon Hood, the lead singer, passed away a couple years after this. He had some substance issues, and really, I mean, they only had a couple of albums soup, and I actually like the album soup. I think maybe they were kind of destined for more. They could have been destined for more, but I mean, this is one where the where a premature passing of the voice of the band kind of brings along the only hit, and which was unfortunate. I think there's like a documentary coming out that or is just out about it's like his home movies and everything, but it's like it's so removed. I mean, he died in what, 95, so it's like it's. And maybe for our demographic only, maybe. But yeah, and they still play. Blind Melon still plays, which is, I mean, but nobody. They're not going to sniff a hit. They're just not. It's been 25 years. But yeah, that's right. My number two.
Good pick. Hey, Brendan, what do you got?
Hey, Aaron, I'm going back to 1974. I Can't Stand the Rain by Ann Peebles, and for me, and I think many others. We first came to know this song via what Missy Elliott did with it, which was fantastic. But then going back to the source material, the original recording, it's great. I mean, that like intro riff thing, it's just so like quirky. And then the song grooves hard when you like, it just feels like it, like a bus on hydraulics. Like it just just like releases. And that's my description of how good the song feels. That's why it's number two.
Yeah, that's a great pick with the electric timbali.
That's what it is. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yep, electric timbali. Freddie, what's your number? Is it two?
Number two. What Becomes of the Brokenhearted? Motown for Jimmy Ruffin, David Ruffin's brother. And what a great song. It was, I guess it was also included in the documentary about the Motown session players as well.
Oh man, that version with Joan Osborne.
Joan Osborne, yeah. Oh,
I am not ashamed to say I cry every time I watch that.
But this is, you know, this is the definitive version to me. Jimmy Ruffin, What Becomes of the Brokenhearted? Great song, Motown production.
Definitely a great song. Definitely a great song. I'm gonna give you my number one hit wonder. This is one of my favorite songs growing up. It is The Butt by EU, released in 1988. Funny enough, this was written by, you know, jazz super great Marcus Miller, which I thought was just like fascinating. I was like, what Marcus? I mean, I know you're doing that Miles stuff, which was weird, but I mean, what are you doing writing this? Anyway, this was actually for the School Days soundtrack, which I love that movie, and it fits perfectly within the scope of that movie. If you've seen the video for Doing the Butt, it was great. I used to like ride the school bus to school, and you could just hear this playing outside. This song is just the best, and it's got that go-go beat, which personally I think should be more widespread. I'm always looking for a go-go beat. That's my number one pick, The Butt. And Adam, go for it.
I don't know. Why isn't Marcus Miller known as the butt guy? You know, I mean, that's such a popular thing.
Well, we can start something here.
Yeah.
Oh, you know Marcus Miller? The butt guy.
You mean the guy from The Butt?
Yeah.
The guy that wrote The Butt? Bass player. Oh, yeah, I guess he plays bass too, huh? All right. And for my number one, which might create a little bit of a stir because they weren't exactly a one-hit wonder in Britain, but in the States, at least to my understanding, T-Rex only had one hit, and that was a Bang a Gong, aka Get It On. It's kind of it's one of those songs that, you know, it's on all those, you know, compilations of, you know, back in those. It's just on one of those. It's on those, like, hey, remember the 70s things, you know. It's just one of those songs, and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, this song. And then Mark Bolan, I mean, he basically invented glam. And it is, I think, really with that, I mean, they had a ton of, they were like, I mean, T-Rex really is just Mark Bolan, but they were like the next Beatles there in Britain. They had a ton of hits in a row. He was like, you know, big thing there. Just, no, the marketing never really took in the States. They never really, I mean, the next out, the follow-up album for this one, which I love, Slider, they just forgot. He forgot to tour. He literally forgot to tour for the Slider. I mean, this, I think it was just a series of missteps that kept them from being huger than they were. And I don't think America quite got glam, but I picked T-Rex as the number one American one hit wonder.
Nice. Brandon.
Yeah. My number one, 96 Tears by Question Mark and the Mysterians from 1966. I love this song. I love everything about it. I love the aura of Question Mark. I mean, that's how he goes by, the symbol Question Mark, not the word spelled out. To me, this is one of the best uses of the Farfisa keyboard that I could ever imagine. And just everything about this song is right to me. So that's my number one.
That was an awesome pick. I never heard of the song before. And it was quite a treat. Quite a treat. Freddie, what do you have?
Yeah.
For your...
Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky. Apparently, he got inspired by hearing, I forget, some country singer sing a gospel song on television, and he said, Porter Wagoner. He said, I can do that, and he wrote the song in 15 minutes.
Wow.
And it's a great tune, great recording. The guitar sound, the fuzz guitar sound is amazing. And I think they hired a bona fide gospel group to sing background vocals, and song still gets me every time I hear it. My number one pick.
It's a you know, a simple rock tune pretty much, but the groove is killer. It's just such a killer groove, and just like the rockness of it is amazing.
Iconic.
And with that, we're going to take a short break and be back in a second with some more discussion. Hold on. And we are back. Those are great picks, guys. And, you know, I want to kind of start with you, Brendan. There was a song you mentioned in your top three one-hit wonders, I Can't Stand the Rain, by Ann Peebles, 1973. I've heard this song a lot, and I really enjoy it. It's killer groove, when I was doing a little research on this, I realized that it was produced by Willie Mitchell. You know, tell me a little bit about this pick, and you know why, you know, another reason why, or go into a little bit more why it was something special for you.
This song connected with me and has connected with me for a while. As I said, like, my introduction to it was through Missy Elliott. And then, as so many people, I guess, of a certain generation, when you learn of samples through the hip hop version, then you have to go back and listen to the original that came out before your time. And so that was kind of my evolution of it. And I think for me, this is like just one of the coolest examples of that. Like, the sample is really well done and it's recognizable and it's pretty well intact. And then you go to the original, and then it's like, oh man, but then there's like this cool B section, and then it's got, and her voice is great, and just everything about it is, to me, just like it's perfect from beginning to end. I love it.
Also, looking at this song and listening to this song, you know what she sounds like, and the whole thing sounds like, it actually sounds like Al Green to me. If you're saying if Al Green was singing this song, it'd be like, yeah, it's almost like an Al Green song. Yeah.
Same producer.
Yep. There you go. Same producer.
Yeah, it's real, like, kind of slinky that way.
Yeah, definitely is. Definitely is. Adam, let me go to you now. So when you gave your pick, T-Rex Bang and Gong, Get It On, you know, in my research, I actually found that in the UK, it was just titled Get It On. And then for the US, they titled it Bang a Gong, Get It On, which kind of leads to the fact that, you know, they might have had a couple more hits in the UK as opposed to, you know, just this one huge one the US. Kind of tell me a little bit about that song, and have you heard any other UK, I guess, hits that they had or
what? Oh, they were the thing, like, after the Beatles in the UK. They had a string of hits, a couple great albums. I mean, if you look on on any of the charts, they were, I mean, they had a number of number one hits, but it didn't really translate to the States. Freddie, were there any other hits in the States?
Yes. There's a song called Jeepster.
Oh yeah. Well, how high did that get?
Well, that was used in a couple of movies. The thing is, I remember when, being the old guy, I remember when Electric Warrior came out, and everybody had that record. At least everybody in my camp, everybody in, you know, especially the girls, they loved Mark Bolan.
Oh, he was a snazzy boy.
Yeah. So Jeepster was also a big hit.
But then why is it only Bang a Gong gets on like the, you know, the hit parades?
I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard Jeepster on the radio as well. Children of the Revolution was also a big song that was on the, not the next album, but the album after that, Tanks.
Tanks is good. Are they,
So maybe, you know, if you asked, you know, just somebody on the street, what was the big T-Rex song? They would say, Get It On or Bang It On.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a couple others.
Yeah, I know I was really towing the line on that one, but I really just kind of wanted to talk about T-Rex.
And cool.
When you're in music nerd territory, you know, I'd be like, you know, you get into, I mean, my record club did T-Rex. So I know all of Mark Bolan's songs. I read a bio on him. So he's no wonder to me. And it's just like what I was saying, Slider, the album after Electric Warrior, he forgot to tour over. I mean, they could have been huge, and they were huge in Britain for a couple of years. Aaron, did you have something to add?
Well, yeah, I just want to say that kind of brings me to a larger question on these one hit wonders is that there's like perception and then there's maybe reality.
Right on.
And the perception that Lisa, what I have with this song, is like, yeah, I've heard in like a video game or something. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's that one hit song from this one band.
Right.
And so when you put it on the list, I was like, makes perfect sense.
Right. Then you come to find out
maybe they had more hits. And you know, is that, you know, does that still make them a one hit? So to me, even though you say they've got a lot of hits, they're still a one hit wonder.
And but, to probably like 80% of the American public, they're a one hit wonder. You know?
Yeah. But in reality, maybe they have had, you know, some stuff going on. Brendan, what do you think?
I guess it's just the nature of this topic. It's ridiculously harsh to label an artist as a one hit wonder because
it's not a positive.
I don't think any artist would appreciate being called that because all of these artists have a body of work. It's just what did the public decide was good enough?
What does revisionist history tell me?
Yeah.
I was just during the first half, I was looking up Maria Muldaur's discography. She had released like 30 albums.
Wow.
So, you know, and also appeared on Jerry Garcia Band albums and you know, other people's records. So she has had a career.
Yeah, that's the point. She has had a wonderful career, but most of it's garbage. Brendan, you're going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, to contradict myself, the one exception that I see, correct me if I'm wrong, is Louie Louie. And like, I don't know what else they did, but for me, like my only entry point into that song is Frank Zappa's like ironic use of it. He had a strange relationship with the song. I don't know how much you guys get into that stuff, but like, there's versions of him doing it, I think, with the London Phil and then on like a church pipe organ. It would always be the butt of a musical joke with him, which I think is part of the legacy of Louie Louie.
Is that a good legacy?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know how Zappa truly felt about it. I think he was kind of making fun of the song, but like he also had this like true love of like doo-wop music, which Louie Louie is not that, but it kind of has a little bit of a thread to doo-wop, I think.
Yeah, I think it was written by, that's the song that was written by Richard Berry, right? And I think he was actually a doo-wop guy. So it did kind of come from that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That thread. I mean, the also catch of that song is like, yes, you've heard it a lot, but it's actually, if you just listen to it, it's cool. You know, if you just kind of take, you just listen to it and say, hey, I'm going to listen to this tune. And, you know, if I've never heard any before, I'm like, yo, this is pretty cool.
I forgot how rough around the edges that tune is. Isn't like, doesn't the singer like comes in early after the solo and it's just,
yes,
it's so sloppy.
I love
but
it.
Great. But great, right? Yeah. Yeah.
That's the way it is in our brains now. You can't hear it. Can't hear it any other way.
Right.
You know what I mean?
A small sidebar about Louie Louie. There was a radio station. I'm trying to remember if it was Philly or not. This is a little light in my memory, but I remember there was I don't even remember.
WMMR.
When the 24 hours of it. I think
they had a parade. They even had a parade, the Louie Louie parade.
What? That's
ridiculous. I was involved one year.
Really?
Yes, I hate to say it. We were actually on a float going down the street
and playing it.
It was being played, but people were singing, and it was ridiculous.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Zappa would have loved that.
Oh my god. Maybe
they invited him. He was still alive.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just want to add, Mott the Hoople did have one other tune that was pretty big, and maybe fans of theirs would argue more than one, but All the Way to Memphis was a pretty big tune for them as well. Mm. Look it up.
I've never heard that tune.
It's a rocking little
take
number.
Your advice on that one.
And Roll Away the Stone. Way. Roll Away the Stone was another one. But All the Way to Memphis was pretty big for them.
Uh-huh. So clearly the phrasing is up to interpretation on this. This is, you know,
quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean, right. Yeah, I mean, I you know, if I would have, you know, been around for T-Rex, maybe I wouldn't have had them on my list because I probably would have been a fan back then too.
Possibly.
But I know we had some honorable mentions on these too, because, you know, there's always a lot of tunes to pick from. Aaron, what were your what did you have as your honorable mentions to these very loose interpretations of one-hit wonders?
Well, thank you for asking, Adam. So the one that's like probably, I think, the one of the most recent songs that, you know, any of us has picked is Gnarls Barkley's Crazy from 2006. That was a huge hit. I actually have a hate-love relationship with that song. I think
that different than love-hate?
No, it's not.
It's more hate than love?
Yeah, it's more hate than love. It's more hate than love.
I hate love, yeah.
I appreciate, like, artistically where it's coming from. I just hate the song. I guess that's it. But it was a huge hit, and it was kind of different than what was out there at the time. And so that was definitely one of my honorable mentions. And then I'll just give this one other one because nobody's ever heard of it, and I just love it so much. And I actually changed it when I was listening to Rockwell. One of your guys' pick is I picked Centipede from Reby Jackson.
The Forgotten Jackson.
The Forgotten Jackson, released in 1984, and is written by Michael Jackson. If you guys haven't heard the song, check it out. It's on the Spotify playlist. This song it might be the best Jackson song ever. So just so you guys know that. Song is amazing. The Forgotten Jackson. But kind of going back to that Rockwell song, whose pick was that? Whose pick was that Rockwell song?
That was mine.
Brendan.
That was Brendan's, huh?
Love that song.
Yeah, yeah. What do you like about that song, Freddie?
It's got a good beat. You can dance to it. I don't know. It was a great song.
Yeah. It's
for the time.
I think it's a weird song, first and foremost, for me anyway. Like, it's cool, and like, the hook is great, which I think is the memorable bit. And the more I was looking into that song, it's interesting. Like, Rockwell was like Berry Gordy's kid, I think.
Yep.
And then the Michael Jackson guest thing, they deny any sort of nepotism there, but how could there not be?
Come on. Right.
And it was his one hit. So like, it's pretty clear that that seemed to be a manufactured arrangement there, but
no.
Just for me, a personal anecdote. I remember seeing one of my favorite bands is Antibalas, and they did a cover of that when
like
3 years ago at Ardmore Music Hall, and it was really cool.
Wow. Mm. Interesting.
So there's one kind of direction I'd like to kind of go into next with this stuff in this conversation, and that's 90s rock and roll. Now, a personal disclaimer, generally, I do not like 90s rock and roll, but you guys have some of these. I see you shaking your head, Freddie, like you hate them too, I know.
So, was there rock and roll in the 90s?
Well, according to our compadres here, Plowed by Sponge was in 94. That was one of Brennan's picks. And then we have for album No Rain by Blind Melon. Also, Adam, you know, one of Adam's honorable mention picks, What's Up by Four Non-Blondes. Guys, explain yourselves.
This is kind of like Ooh Child, where you just find one little thing that works, and it's I don't even know if I mean, it didn't say one hit wonders that you like.
That's true. Maybe you hate love them.
I don't know if I hate What's Up or I love What's Up, but I know, like,
that's fair.
That I know it, and I know it, and it's always there. And it's really, Linda Perry went on to, like, she produced like Pink and stuff. She had a pretty good career, but like Four Non-Blondes, it's like, name me a second Four Non-Blondes song. I went with one where I knew it'd have controversy with T-Rex, and I was almost a little tongue-tied trying to explain myself a little bit, because I'm like, they were like the next Beatles in Britain, but I'm like, they have that sentiment in the States, but Four Non-Blondes, there's no doubt this is to the letter of the law. This is like, did they have another song, or was it just a bunch of like remixes on their album with a little choo-choo train on the front? Everyone remembers that cover, and it's saying like Ooh Child. It's just like, you can go, hey, what's going on? And you're like, you know, most of the song.
And that video is memorable.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you can't unsee that.
That's one of the 80s and 90s one hit wonders. Like with Blind Melon, it's like that became a bigger hit because of the B-Girl.
That's what I meant. Blind Melon's
and that Blind Melon, yeah.
And
that video,
psychedelic in nature with that song. Like that's even that seems like that song is from another time, even though it was like so 90s in its own way.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. I was listening to some of those songs. Brennan, please tell me a little bit more about what's good about Plowed. That's by the Sponge.
Man, it's
the Sponge.
The Sponge Band. SpongeBob Band.
I think they're just a classic example of a 90s alternative one-hit wonder for me. And every time I hear that song, I see Plaid, you know, and I see like bad haircuts and unkempt hair. And you know, again, it's the use of it in Empire Records is total nostalgia for me. And I think without that usage, that song would not have made my list. It's something about the moment in the movie. It just encompassed this like angst and anger and this rebellion thing that that just was really working for me at the time.
And so another thing that I was thinking about along the lines of those 90s tunes, we actually have a good collection of 80s tunes here, I believe. With, you know, Somebody's Watching, honorable mention by Brendan, the Doctor in TARDIS by the Time Lords. And then Freddie has one of his honorable mentions was Too Shy by Kajugugugu. And then honorable mention by Adam, Safety Dance, Men with Hats. In general, I liked all these songs. Is that like maybe it's just my orientation with the 80s, but like for instance, the Kakujuguju, that tune is amazing.
Pretty good.
Too Shy? Have you guys heard that song?
Yeah.
Brendan or Adam?
No. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what's going on in the verse. This is more of like a one riff, more of a one riff wonder for me.
And their hairdos. Oh my goodness.
But well, tell me about that Safety Dance song. That song is great too. I really liked it.
I have that album on vinyl, and it's just They just never had another hook. And I want to do kind of iterate in this as we're throwing like the, it's, you know, this can become kind of a demeaning conversation, but it's like, it's hard just to write one hit. And I think that has to be kept into perspective. It's like, you know, how many bands are out there that would love just to be Men Without Hats and have that one hit. And we also know artists that we have played with and opened for that have made a whole career off of one hit. So it's like, I just want to kind of throw that asterisk in all this. It's like, yeah, it's hard to even get to one, but then it's just like, but then you get to one and then you get thrown through the meat grinder if you don't get to, you know, a second one.
So unless you're Rick Astley and then you make a whole career out of being a joke.
Well, a meme. He's
never
made.
Never want to get you up. Never want to say goodbye. That's the song, right?
Yep.
I mean, who wouldn't love to become memed like that? Yeah. The Rick roll.
Yep.
Yep.
I do love that song. But a kind of a larger question to kind of what we're talking about, the 80s and 90s. Do you guys think that maybe all these one hit wonders became more popular in the 80s and 90s than like before in the 70s or 60s or 50s?
Well, I think when we were talking about the videos have made a big thing in the for the 80s and 90s, you know, because everyone was all about wanting their MTV and even, you know, and then a lot of these things are like, oh yeah, you remember the video. But actually I wanted to bring up a couple of, really early, just big hits that weren't committed to, you know, with videos. And the earlier ones we have, Wipeout by the Safaris. That is their only hit, and that's from the 60s. And also,
I thought about actually including that.
Me too.
That's one of those part of American culture things. And another one I wanted to throw on there, just because I'm a big Pee Wee fan, is Tequila.
Ooh,
great choice
by the Champs. And once again, it's like that was from like the 50s, and they didn't do anything else. So it's interesting. I mean, how bands came and gone then, and you got to wonder if there'd be more if they were like more like promotional videos and everything.
Sure,
like these 80s and 90s ones we're getting.
So going along with that, when I was making this list, I was deliberately trolling our resident Americana guy, because I put Act of Grey by the Grateful Dead on there, which technically was their only charting hit, right?
Hit, quote unquote. Yeah.
So that they sort of smashed the mold there, because they obviously had an enormous career and a lot of songs that I love. I mean, I'm not even a huge Dead guy, but Touch of Grey is not even really up there for me as one of my favorites. But for some reason, that hit a particular mark at some point, resonated with enough folks, and the video for that is pretty fantastic.
It is a good video.
Yeah, it is.
But when I saw that, that's like, there's not the one hit wonder. Like, they had a one hit and I wonder what happened. And it's like, they're more, you know, I wonder.
And so going along the lines of, you know, thinking about artists in terms of if they get a hit, what do they do next? Is it sad when an artist, you know, tries to do, you know, tries to get another hit and they just try to put out the same song? Or that happens often. You know, what do you guys think about, but that when an artist gets a hit and they just try to do like, it sort of worked for the Motown sound when they were doing My Guy and then they did My Girl and da 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 da. But for specific artists, what do you guys think about that? Brandon, what do you think, man?
I think it, to me, I just, in my head, I so clearly just go to, I see through the marketing. I feel like the record label is like, do that thing again. Whatever that thing was, that was good. Do it again. And I don't know how often the artist is into that. I have no evidence of that, but it just seems so transparently obvious to me that they're just trying to recreate something like a sequel to a movie that didn't need to have a sequel.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the first movie was like a novelty. When you think about, you know, songs like Who Let the Dogs Out or the Thong Song or Mbop or, you know, all these other songs. Like, what do you think about the hit song as a novelty thing?
That's another one I almost put on my list.
Mbop?
Yeah.
Answer. Yeah, but they have a good career, though.
They have a career.
Yeah,
they do. Yeah, they can go to any little theater around here, and you know, and Sell out.
Yep.
I wonder where they play that in the set. Is it always last? Or nobody leaves?
I don't know. They had other charting. Would you call them hits? I don't know.
Not like Mbop.
You are just the pronunciation king today. You're like, catch a goo goo to do. Yeah. No. Here's one to look at. The when you're talking about that, my mind immediately goes to Sugar Ray, who did their one hit. Okay, so they got their hit "Fly." Their little, you know, I just won't fly. But then you ever listen to the rest of the album? It's just like punk. And then it's just like hardcore punk. Nothing like "Fly." And then they go to the next album. It's like every morning. There's like they're rewriting "Fly," and then it's just a bunch of punk. And it's like, I'm not a fan. But you know, they made their money doing that. But it's just, that is the prime example of, like, you know, pandering to the hit.
So I have to interject here when we're talking about novelty records, because one of my honorable mentions to me is like the quintessential novelty record. It's Doctor in the TARDIS by the Time Lords. And so there's so much to be said about these two guys that wrote this song. I just finished this book called The KLF, which is the story of their band, The KLF. So the two of them had many iterations of different bands, but they put out this song, which is sampling Doctor Who and Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll. And Whoa. They were just like total unapologetic thieves in sampling. And they had a hit. They had a number one record in the UK with this song, Doctor in the TARDIS. And it was on Top of the Pops, and they didn't want to go on. So they credited the song to the car, which they called the Time Lord. So the car goes on Top of the Pops and flashes its headlights in sync with the song. And Gary Glitter, they get him to dance around. This whole story of this band is insane. And after this song, they put out a book called The Manual, How to Have a Number One the Easy Way, which is, it's just Whoa. Everything about this band. They're like part satire, part anarchy, part irony, everything about them. Like, it's just so much to be said about them. But like, if anyone's interested, the KLF is an amazing read, and it just tells their story of their very interesting career.
Nice. And taking it away from the novelty aspect, Brendan, I do want to talk to you about your song, your top pick, 96 Tears, Question and the Mysterians from 1966.
Question marks.
This song was awesome. Like, I've never heard this song before. The organ was it's awesome. Or the, what did you say, the Farfisa?
The Farfisa,
it's awesome. This song is like, it is a mystery. Tell me a little bit about, you know, how you discovered this one, because this one's not one that you just kind of pick up in your one hit wonder box.
Right. So this song I like sort of knew about for a while, but it came up for me recently with an artist that I've been working with, who you all know very well, who we've talked about. And we're working on a tune, and she made a reference to 96 Tears because there's a Farfisa part in this one of the songs we're working on. And she's like, give it the 96 Tears thing. And I was like, I should look that up. And I was like, oh, that song. Oh, wow. That song really rocks. It's so cool. So to me, and I have such a soft spot for a Farfisa organ. I think it's just such a cool texture, and it's just like so upfront in 96 Tears. I think it's just perfect in every way. And then I was like looking into Question Mark and his like persona, and it's just like, I just think the whole thing is so cool.
A couple of things about that song. First of all, I own that 45 when it came out.
Nice.
Wow.
And in a previous life, when I worked for disc makers, a CD manufacturer, that guy called up and they got put through to my desk. And he said, yeah, hey, this is Question Mark. I think they were from Detroit originally, even though the record was on Cameo Parkway, a Philadelphia label originally. And I had to ask the guy his name because I needed it to put in the database. And he hung up on me.
Wait, time out. So he said, hey, this is Question Mark. That's what he said?
Yeah. From Question no Mark way. And the Mysterians. Absolutely.
Referred to and I was like, Question Mark.
I was like, oh, wow. I was fanboying out. I was geeking, you know?
And then he hung up on you?
When I asked him his real name, I needed to you know, get that information, that was the end of the conversation.
And he committed to his persona in a hard way.
Yeah.
Wow. What a story.
Now, Aaron, I got something I want to pose to you as kind of a metaphysical question about one-hit wonders.
Yeah, hit me.
Do you think the recipients of the one-hit wonderdom find it as a blessing to have gotten that one hit, or as a curse, as an always have to live the life of that person who did that song?
I think on balance, it's a blessing. Yeah, if it happened to me, I'd be like, yep, yeah, good.
I'm the butt guy. Yep.
Yeah. Just call me Aaron the Butt Brown. Yeah, so on balance, definitely positive. I think also though it kind of distinguishes the you know, the more artisty of the bunch. And if you're more a writer or, you know, creator or producer, then I think you can utilize that jumping off point to something, whether it be like with the woman from Four Non Blondes,
right? Yeah,
or you know, one of these other people. But if you're just like there's this artist A. Marie who had this one hit single, One Thing, back in like the 90s or whatever, and then she just faded off because she really couldn't do anything else. It's just like, it wasn't her thing. Or even if you think about my number one pick, EU, The Butt, it's like they just had one thing. It wasn't like they really were, they didn't even write that song. So it's not like their artistic vision was, it was a start of the artistic vision. It was just like, yeah, we got this thing, and it's cool, and it made a lot of money. So that's kind of my overall take on that one. Brendan, do you have anything to follow up on that one? Or
I think it's interesting. There are, like you've just said, like kind of different camps of this. There are the artists that it does feel sort of manufactured, like we're going after a number one and there's not much else in terms of artistry involved in the career. But my one asterisk I would say about, would you be okay with having a one hit song of that would be your whole thing? Like, yeah, but also, one artist that came up for me is the Pogues. And what about Fairy Tale of New York? Like, that was clearly their most enormous hit. And it's a Christmas song. It's an amazing Christmas song. But like, if your career then becomes known as you made a hit Christmas song, how would you feel about that?
I would feel that I'm making money every single year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but their career is so much more, take it from somebody who plays in a band that basically can do the whole Pogues catalog. It's deep.
It is. Yeah. It's a shame.
It is only known really deep.
Yeah. They do have a lot of great songs, but this was the biggest thing they did, or biggest thing that became known for.
Hmm. So then you're thinking from their point with, a broad catalog of, you know, really good tunes, it's probably like, dang, I wish we didn't have this kind of thing hanging over our heads. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe. And also, like, related to that, the Waitresses and their Christmas song was enormous too. They did have another giant hit, but I feel like, I forget the name of that Christmas song, but it's
Christmas Wrapping.
That's the one. Thanks. Like that one is just always going to stay with them.
Yeah.
Peel off on a personal front and in a smaller non-hit like thing, from like my own experience, just I say when I was in college and playing in multiple bands and trying to write original music and everything, but I'd always have my own one hit wonder of the moment was I'd do a quick like countrified jingle of the Charles in Charge song from the TV series, and it was like
a big hit.
It was like my most requested thing. So when I think about it, when I was posing that question on that front, it kind of took me back to there. And I'm like, I could write the greatest song in the history of mankind, and people just asked me to play Charles in Charge. You know, yeah. And so, you know, it's nice to be wanted for a song, but it's like, you know, I can see Brendan on your end. Like, do you want that Charles in Charge sized cloud hanging over your head every time no matter even if you write the greatest thing ever.
Another guy with the kind of similar kind of setup would be like Jimmy Ruffin with his What Becomes of a Broken Heart. That was a huge hearted, What Becomes of the Broken Hearted. That was a huge, huge song. But for him, it's like, you know, that was it. And everybody, and then for him also, it's like, you got this brother over here that's like,
yeah,
like the dude, David. So for him, man, that must have been crazy tough. What do you think,
it's Freddie? It's my turn. And no, it's not.
What do you think, Freddie?
I was just going to say real quick, like, can you imagine being an artist touring like year in and year out, and like every show the crowd just like shouts out for your one hit? Like, that's got to wear on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So Freddie, what did you have to say about the David Ruffin thing at all, anything at all? Or
I mean, no, I guess it was understood that, you know, Jimmy was going to get his shot, and you know, I don't really know much else about his career, but all I do know is it's a great song. I just want to address one other tune that I had as my
good I was waiting for
as my honorable mention is Jump Around by House of Pain.
Yes.
Everybody remember that video?
Oh, how could you not? Could you not?
So the thing is, they were a band from LA. But looking at the video, you just assumed they were from Boston.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep. And one of the things I actually learned, I did a little research on this, is that they were produced by DJ Muggs of, this yes. song was produced by DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill.
Right.
It was supposed to be like a Cypress Hill song, but I forgot the dude didn't want it. Then they said that he offered it to Ice Cube and he turned it down. And then it ended up with House of Pain in this song. But I got to say, this song sucks, but that's just me.
And you see that at a club, everyone's jumping around. That's like, it's one of those things in the club culture. It is a thing.
Yeah, I'm jumping in my car and going home.
That's funny. You know, I just realized, I just looked it up, that was New York City, St. Patrick's Day Parade. All this time, I thought it was Boston. Anyway, okay.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
There is one other thing. We're going to wrap up soon, but listening to the tunes that we all put together, there's one song, Ooh Child of the Five Stair Steps. I was listening to the song and I noticed, man, the drums sound fantastic on this song. Fantastic. Did a little research. And of course, Freddie, who was it on the drums? Your man, Bernard Purdy.
Oh, that's Purdy playing drums on that?
That's Purdy playing drums on
that song. I did not know. Oh, the groove and the fills are incredible.
Yeah. And actually, if you listen to it from a production standpoint, what they do is they do some like on this fills, they do panning, they like pan the drum.
Wow, cool.
And it's so good. I don't know if anybody else kind of picked up on the drums on that song.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, I have in the past, but yeah, okay, very cool.
For me, that song, I was like, man, the drums, the song's like, okay. But the drums are amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of fills going on.
So before we wrap up on this tune, is there any kind of overarching thing that you guys want to just kind of lay out there for folks before we take out? I know, Adam, you have a lot of deep thoughts for us. On...
I'm always a wrap up guy. Yeah. But the point I was kind of driving in the middle is in that, like, it's so hard just to write one, and I just don't want to think we're like, you know, busting people's stones here. It's like, I think any of us here would be like, man, I would love a hit. Even to have that cloud hanging over you, at least you got something hanging over you. You know what I mean? Like, there's no shame in having one hit. It's like, it's saying it's one more than I have. You know what I mean? And as you were saying, Aaron, a lot of these folks, use it as a stepping stone to venture off into other other things. It's like, it wasn't like one hit and they hit the, I mean, some did hit the wall, but I mean, you know, it's not necessarily the end for some of these folks.
Yeah, definitely. And Brendan, as our resident producer, when you're producing folks, are you ever like, yeah, let's get this one hit, guys? Do you put on your showbiz talks like, all right, guys, we got to get a lot of cowbell on this one just to blow up the charts?
So I'll say a couple of things about that. I will say every artist and every project that I've ever worked on where one of the initial conversations they bring up, what do you think? Do you think this has like some sort of legs as far as like radio or charts? Like every project where that is an early conversation, the project never turns out well. Ever. So like that for me, that is never a guiding force. It's like, let's make it great to us. And if we love it, hopefully somebody else will love it too. That's like, that's what I've learned, to let that guide you. But then the other side of it is, some musicians I've worked with, and maybe you guys have experienced this too, will have all sorts of negative things to say about pop music. And a lot of our picks are in the pop spectrum, just slagging it off like, oh, it's too simple, it's easy, it's all this. It's like, I could do that. It's like, oh, you want to have a hip hop song? Go ahead, try it.
Make it happen.
Yeah. It's like, if it's so easy.
Your name is not, hey, on that note, Freddie, your name is not Peter Gabriel, huh? With the Soul reference? Did you get that? Only Peter Gabriel can kind of like come from, you know, strange land to be like, yeah, I'm going to make a pop record and like kill it, you know?
Yeah.
It's not that easy.
Nope.
Yeah. But on that note, guys, I think we've had a great discussion here today. And we are going to end it there and come back next week with another pod for you. And this has been The List, a Write Fiction podcast. Please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite listening app. And we will talk to you again next week. Take care.